Chapter one, take two,
Nice.
But finally the end come to Sophia and Miss Eleanor Jane, I think. And it wasn't nothing to do with Henrietta, who hate Miss Eleanor Jane's guts. It was Miss Eleanor Jane herself and that baby she went and had. Every time Sophia turned round, Miss Eleanor Jane was shoving Ronald Stanley Earle in her face. He, a little fat white something without much hair, looked like he headed for the Navy. "Ain't little Ronald sweet," say Miss Eleanor Jane to Sophia. "Daddy just love him," she say. "Love having a grandchild named for him, and love so much like him, too." Sophia don't say nothing. Stand there ironing some of Susie Q and Henrietta's clothes. "And so smart," say Eleanor Jane. Daddy says he never saw a smarter baby. Stanley Earle's mama say he's smarter than Stanley Earle was when he was his age. Sophia still didn't say nothing. Finally, Eleanor Jane noticed. "And you know how some white folks is, won't let well enough alone. If they want too bad enough, they're going to harass a blessing from you if it kill." Sophia mighty quiet this morning, Miss Eleanor Jane say, like she's just talking to Ronald Stanley. He stared back at her out of his big, stuck-open eyes. "Don't you think he's sweet?" she asked again. "He's sure fat," say Sophia, turning over the dress she ironing. "And he's sweet, too," say Miss Eleanor Jane. "Just as plump as he can be," say Sophia, "and tall. But he's sweet, too," say Eleanor Jane. "And he's smart." She haul off and kiss him upside the head. He rub his head. Say, "Ye." "Ain't he the smartest baby you ever saw?" she asked Sophia. "He got a nice size head on him," say Sophia. "You know, some people place a lot of weight on head size. Not a whole lot of hair on it, either. He gonna be cold this summer, for sure." She folded the piece she ironed and put it on the chair. "Just a sweet, smart, cute, innocent little baby boy," say Miss Eleanor Jane. "Don't you just love him?" she asked Sophia point blank. Sophia sigh, put down her iron, stare at Miss Eleanor Jane and Ronald Stanley. All the time, me and Henrietta over in the corner playing pity-pat. Henrietta act like Miss Eleanor Jane ain't alive, but both of us hear the way the iron sound when Sophia put it down. The sound have a lot of old and new stuff in it. "No, ma'am," say Sophia. "I do not love Ronald Stanley Earle." "That's what you've been trying to find out ever since he was born, and now you know." Me and Henrietta look up. Miss Eleanor Jane just the quick done put Ronald Stanley on the floor when he crawling round knocking stuff over. Head straight for Sophia's stack of iron clothes and pull it down on his head. Sophia take up the clothes, straighten them out, stand by the ironing board with her hand on the iron. Sophia the kind of woman, no matter what she have in her hand, it look like a weapon. Eleanor Jane start to cry. She always have felt something for Sophia. If not for her, Sophia never would have survived living in her daddy's house. But so what? Sophia never wanted to be there in the first place. Never wanted to leave her own children. "Too late to cry, Miss Eleanor Jane," say Sophia. "All us can do now is laugh. Look at him," say she. And she do laugh. "He can't even walk, and already he in my house messing it up. Did I ask him to come? Do I care whether he's sweet or not? Will it make any difference in the way he grew up to treat me what I think? You just don't like him because he looked like daddy," say Miss Eleanor Jane. "You don't like him because he looked like daddy," say Sophia. "I don't feel nothing about him at all. I don't love him. I don't hate him. I just wish he couldn't run loose and all the time messing up folks' stuff. All the time. All the time," say Miss Eleanor Jane. "Sophia, he's just a baby, not even a year old. He only been here 5 or 6 times." "I feel like he'd been here forever," say Sophia. "I just don't understand," say Miss Eleanor Jane. "All the other colored women I know love children. The way you feel is something unnatural." "I love children," say Sophia. "But all the colored women that say they love yours is lying. They don't love Ronald Stanley any more than I do. But if you so badly raised as to ask them, what you expect them to say? Some colored people so scared of white folks they claim to love the cotton gin." "But he's just a little baby," say Miss Eleanor Jane, like saying this is supposed to clear up everything. "What you want from me," say Sophia. "I feel something for you because out of all the people in your daddy's house, you showed me some human kindness. But on the other hand, out of all the people in your daddy's house, I showed you some. Kind feeling is all I have to offer you. I don't have nothing to offer your relatives, but just what they offer me. I don't have nothing to offer him." Ronald Stanley by this time is over on Henrietta Palla looking like he's trying to rape her foot. Finally, he starts to chew her leg and Henrietta reach up on the windowsill and hand him a cracker. "I feel like you're the only person love me," say Eleanor Jane. "Mama only loved Junior," she say, "'cause that's who Daddy really loved." "Well," say Sophia, You got your own husband to love you now. Look like he don't love nothing but that cotton gin, she say. 10 o'clock at night and he's still down there working. When he not working, he playing poker with the boys. My brother see a lot more of Stanley Earle than I do. Maybe you ought to leave him, say Sophia. You got a kin at Atlanta, go stay with some of them, get a job. Miss Eleanor Jane's tossed back her hair, act like she don't even hear this, it was such a wild notion. I got my own trouble, say Sophia, and when Reynold Stanley grow up, he's going to be one of them. But he won't, say Miss Eleanor Jane. I'm his mom and I won't let him be mean to colored. You and whose army, say Sophia. The first word he likely to speak won't be nothing he learned from you. You telling me I won't even be able to love my own son, say Miss Eleanor Jane? No, say Sophia, that's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you I won't be able to love your own son. You can love him just as much as you want to, but be ready to suffer the consequences. That's how the colored live.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Chapter 1, Take 2, the podcast where we read a book, watch the film, and discuss the adaptation. My name is Maddie.
I'm Brianna.
And if you couldn't tell already from that beautiful reading, this week we are covering The Color Purple.
We are.
The Color Purple. An American story for the whole world. It's about life. It's about love. It's about us.
The Color Purple, written by Alice Walker in 1982.
It's a great book.
It's a great book, a great movie. I was very prepared to be upset by the movie and the book, and I was.
It's an upsetting text. But it's supposed to be. It's supposed to make you feel things.
Well, I did. Why do you want to read that piece of the book, Brianna?
So, what I discovered after watching the movie is that there is a lot of controversy over the fact that it was directed by a white man.
Sure.
And I'm not surprised. I am one of the people who tend to go, if it's a black person's story, a black person should be telling it.
Mm.
And in this
agree with that.
Particular instance, I definitely understand that it should have been told by a black person. So one of the problems with, so as people, when we read something, we perceive it based on our own experiences and we put it in the context of how we see the world. So
yeah, everything's through our own lens.
Absolutely. So Steven Spielberg, when he read the book, he put it in the context of how he saw the world, and he focused largely on Celie's relationship with Nettie, which is definitely a massive aspect of the book. But what we miss is some of the things that probably would have stood out to black folks. And that section is one of the ones that I think I really like, because when I look at something like The Color, The Help, and the controversy that The Help received, this section of the book seems to be what The Help missed among so many things about black people raising white people's kids and the situation they're put in. That kind of cognitive dissonance of like, yeah, I've been a major part of this kid's life and they've probably been nice to me my whole life, but I didn't want to raise them. I wanted to raise my own kids. So this is one of the stories that's taken out of the book, out of the film. And I think it's an important part.
It absolutely is an important part. And I agree with you. I think it's a really wonderful excerpt because, Sophia is talking about how, yeah, of course, what's the child's name?
Miss Eleanor Jane.
Eleanor.
Reynold Stanley Earle.
Yeah. Eleanor would think, she's like, all coloured women love babies, but that's because what's a coloured woman supposed to say when you're being asked by the mayor's daughter, like, what do you think of my son?
Absolutely.
They can't say anything authentic. They have to be like, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, especially in the 1980s.
It was because of Sophia's authenticity that she ended up where she was, because she told the mayor's wife that
she didn't want
to be her maid.
Yeah, 100%.
And then she got slapped and she fought back.
Yeah, and then she got beaten by all the police. I found that scene in the movie very powerful because the white people were all surrounding Oprah Winfrey, playing Sophia, who did an amazing job. She was 31 during the filming. And she screams for help to the police officer, and the police officer runs in and knocks her unconscious with the back of his gun.
And the thing is that today we're still seeing that sort of treatment where black people are calling the police for help.
And then the police get there and assume it's the black person causing the issue or being the aggressor, 100%. So this novel won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1983. Not surprising. So the year after it was written, in 1982.
It's an incredible book.
It is an incredible book. It's a epistolary novel.
Yep, just like Guernsey, but a much better version.
Yes. What is, like, so it's a story told in...
letters or diary entries.
Yes.
Or like telegrams.
I really like how it evolves from Seeley speaking or writing to God and then to Nettie. And her relationship and belief in God changes. Do you want to give us a quick summary of The Color Purple?
What a task.
What is it? It's basically over Seeley's entire life. It's like her whole life. Yeah.
So we meet Seeley when she's 14 and she has been raped by her father. And her mother is dying. She has two children, but she thinks that they could have been killed or drowned or given away. She's not sure.
Yeah. Because he just takes them away.
Takes them away.
Yeah.
And doesn't give her any information. And then... Mr. Albert is what I called him because his name is written out as Mr. Blank in the book.
Yeah.
So Mr. Albert, and we find out later that his first name is Albert. Mr. Albert starts trying to court Seeley's sister Nettie and asks for Nettie's hand in marriage, but the dad doesn't want to give it because he likes Nettie.
This movie is so cringy.
Yeah, it's a dark story.
Mm.
And so... Mr. Albert gets to marry Seeley instead, and Seeley's a really good worker and tries her best to take care of the children, keep the house tidy and stuff like that.
But she's an amazing homekeeper and she farmer. She
is, absolutely.
Yeah.
But she's not as, like, pretty, like, quote-unquote pretty as Nettie. And we find out later that she's also gay, so their relationship isn't super great. Also, he forced her to marry him. Also, he rapes her a lot. Like,
she never wants to have sex with any man. No. So anytime she does, it's always rape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, kind of like, life goes on. Nettie comes to stay with him for a little bit because she runs away because she doesn't want to have an incestuous relationship with her father. And now that Seeley is someone in the town that she could potentially go live with, she has the ability to leave, whereas Seeley didn't have anywhere to go. Mm. So Nettie goes to stay with them, but then gets kicked out because she won't take up a relationship with Mr. Albert. And then we don't hear from Nettie for ages.
Yeah.
And then...
Seeley thinks she's dead.
Yeah. Seeley's life goes on. Harpo, Mr. Albert's son, grows up, marries Sophia, and Seeley tells Harpo to beat Sophia because she's beaten and that's why she minds. But Sophia won't mind Harpo. They have a bit of a row about it. Sophia and Seeley.
Sophia can't believe that another woman told her husband to beat her as a way of helping their relationship.
I felt like, I know that we're at the beginning of this, but I felt like some of the most powerful moments in the film were when Alice Walker's words were taken word for word.
Yeah. It's, there was, an actor error in that scene though, because Sophia, played by Oprah Winfrey, says, if you want a dead, son-in-law, just keep advising him like you're doing. And he's actually, the stepson to Seeley, not son-in-law.
Was it supposed to be stepson?
Yeah.
No.
It's not a problem.
No.
I read about it.
And then, so that's unfolding. Sophia always fights back. She's a really great foil to Seeley.
Yeah.
I feel like.
But then later on in the book, she's punished for it. Like, that's what leads her down the road of turmoil that she goes down.
I have some theories about what to me that means.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
And then we meet Shug. Shug Avery is a singer who comes in and out of Celie and Mr. Albert's life, and Mr. Albert wanted to marry Shug.
But his daddy
wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
And he wasn't brave enough to stand up to him, so Shug moved on. But she still comes in and out of their lives. And the first time they meet, Shug is very sick, and Celie nurses her back to life, and they develop a good friendship, and Shug writes Celie a song.
Yes.
And it's very clear from the get-go that Celie is in love with Shug, and then Shug, over time, develops romantic feelings for Celie.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out, this is like jumping over heaps of stuff, but we find out that Mr. Albert has been hiding Nettie's letters to Celie from her because he feels jilted. And Shug helps Celie get them back. And when she finds out, they leave.
Yeah.
And Celie kind of grows as a person and becomes stronger and braver because of Shug's influence on her.
Mm.
And just that positive influence, just being like, you matter, you're valued. And getting those letters from Nettie, you matter, you're valued.
Yeah.
And she's able to grow and she starts her own pants making business.
Yeah, it's really brushed over in the film because we just see the bit where she leaves Albert's house. But when she moves to Memphis with Shug, she starts her own trouser making business, and she's there for quite a few amount of years.
Yeah. She's there for a while.
Yeah. And she gets a lot of confidence from starting her own business, and Shug actually runs off with a
younger man.
Yeah.
Like a 19-year-old or something.
Yeah, a really young man, and Celie's heartbroken, and then Shug comes back and Celie finds out that her father who raped her was her stepfather, and so her children are not incestuous, but he's died.
And that's brushed over in the film as well.
Yeah, but he's died, and because he wasn't ever her real father left his land and the store to her mother, who then left it to her and Nettie, and she goes back to the house.
And she owns a house and she owns a store, and she's able to open up her own pants store.
Yeah, and then she's making pants for the woman, I really love the symbolism of that.
I do too.
Yeah. And she's literally putting the woman in pants.
Yeah. The story with Sophia plays out very similarly in the film initially. Sophia's asked to be the maid of the mayor's wife. She says no. There's a physical altercation. She punches the mayor and she gets thrown in prison. What frustrates me is that the reason she ends up becoming the mayor's maid is actually a ploy that they're all part of. And Celie and
Squeak?
Squeak, yeah.
Yeah.
Squeak's the one who convinces the jailer, isn't it?
She
goes in and she's just like, you know, she's not even being punished enough.
Yeah, but she's also raped by the chief of police there as well, who's like her uncle or something.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rape.
There's a lot of rape. But she says she's not even, you know, Miss Sophia's not even being punished good enough because she's here and she's getting to avoid being the maid, and that would be the most degrading thing for her. And it's actually a ploy to get her into a safer place than the prison, because she's not safe in the prison.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a lot of power out of the hands of black people, because she gets to live out as a maid, which isn't great. Like, I'm not.
Yeah, she's still, and she's,
but it's safer than being in the prison.
Yeah, and she's basically away from her children
her whole life.
Yeah, their entire lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We kind of covered, so while Celie's life is happening, Nettie does follow the parents who adopted Celie's children to Africa.
Yeah.
A lot of what happens is covered, but one of the things that isn't covered is that she eventually marries the man whose name I can't remember.
The Reverend.
The Reverend, yeah.
Yeah, we'll call him that.
She does eventually marry them because Corinne dies.
Yeah.
And over time they grow up together. And then they come home. And for a while, Celie believes that her sister and her children have drowned in a boating accident.
Mm.
But that's
I was
not
really
accurate.
Prepared for the story to end incredibly sad, and Nettie was dead.
Hmm.
And I was very pleased
that it didn't
by the happy yeah. ending.
So that's kind of the whole thing. Let's talk about the adaptation. Oh,
sure.
Do you want to do your figures?
Yeah,
I'll do my figures.
So the film was directed by Steven Spielberg.
As discussed
in 1985.
He has gone on record saying he felt uncomfortable taking the role and was convinced to take it.
By whom? The production company?
Yeah,
probably.
Somebody, yeah.
He also said that he regrets not going further into the lesbian relationship between Celie and Shug, which I appreciate because I'm a big lesbian. So the budget of the film was $15 million. In the opening weekend in the US, it made $1.7 million. And then worldwide, it made over $98 million. So it definitely was a financial success.
Hmm. It was nominated for 11 Oscars.
Yep.
Didn't win any of them.
Should have.
Yeah.
It's got 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb. I'll quickly go through the incredibly star-studded cast list. So many people kept popping up that I was like, hey, it's them! Hey, it's them! So Whoopi Goldberg plays Celie Johnson. Did you know Whoopi Goldberg, her real name is Karen Elaine Johnson?
I think I have heard that before.
I find it so interesting because, like, Lady Gaga's name's obviously not Lady Gaga, but...
What?
And Pink's name isn't Pink. Like, I imagine Prince's name wasn't Prince, but it never occurred to me to have, like, a performer name.
Hmm.
I just thought that was interesting. Danny Glover plays Albert. It was really interesting for me to see him in such an aggressive role because I grew up in, like, the 90s when he was playing much more of a caring dad role, as well as, like, he was in Lethal Weapon, and he's, like, a good cop.
Hmm.
Like, I'm used to him playing more of a either comedic or, like, a caring figure. Margaret Avery played Shug Avery. Her last name is Avery. Willard E. Pugh played Harpo. Akosia Buzia played Nettie. She is from Ganya.
Cool.
Which is awesome.
She was stunning.
Yeah, and she really beautiful. Very beautiful. Young Celie, who did a great job, was...
Yeah, also very good.
Disrita Jackson. And of course, as we discussed, Oprah Winfrey, played Sophia. And it's really interesting because looking through her page, it seems to be that The Color Purple is being remade in 2023 with Oprah as a producer. So I'm very excited to see that.
So what we need is a black lesbian director. That's what we need.
Oh yeah, because there's all those directors currently now being supported and given funds in Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excuse
if the quality of the sound's a little bit different this week. We are currently in Kaikoura while Bree's on placement, and we're just trying to keep our life on schedule.
Yes. So let's talk about the adaptation. If you're all done.
I believe I am all done. I couldn't find anything on Rotten Tomatoes being rated, but I just...
It's not rated on Rotten Tomatoes?
Not that I could find. But I did find it really interesting that Whoopi Goldberg was 30 during this film and Oprah Winfrey was 31. And I think that that's so weird to me to think, because they look so young.
They do.
Because it was in 1985 and obviously we were under a decade away from being born, but they're in their 30s and we're not even in our 30s, but they're still both alive and really famous.
Mm.
Like, it's weird to think of them before they were super, super famous. Like, so, Oprah Winfrey is like the wealthiest woman of color in the world,
yeah.
I think about that a lot.
So I think about this film, which is set in the 1920s. So it starts out in 1909.
Yeah.
And I think about how someone who, like a black woman who was born in a similar era, could still be alive today reaching 100th birthday. And I think about what she's seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about what she's gone through and mm-hmm. how frustrating it must be for someone like that, just for her to hear, like, racism is dead or that all happened in the past. That's not what's going on right now. I wasn't a part of that. Because even if you're white and alive right now, you have benefited from the systems
yeah.
of oppression.
Absolutely.
That have raised white people up and white families up and that yeah. generational wealth.
100%. Oprah is 67 now.
Yeah.
And she is still alive in America when people of color are just being shot and murdered in the street.
Yeah.
Like, the only difference is now we're capturing it in high definition footage, but it's still happening.
I mean, it's not to say that no progress has been made, but it is to say that
at the end of the day, people are still being murdered.
Yeah. It's what's important to note is that literally we have not been alive long enough for racism to have died out. The Civil Rights Act was only passed in the 1960s. My parents were raised in a freshly desegregated world, but it didn't happen overnight, desegregation, and that harm and that pain and the number of people who didn't agree with desegregation, they were still there, that fought against it openly, a lot of them are still alive.
Absolutely. I just found it on Rotten Tomatoes. It had 94%.
Yeah.
And also this was Steven Spielberg's 8th film as a director.
So.
But I agree with you.
How would you rate the film as an adaptation of the book?
Like 8 out of 10?
Yeah.
It was pretty great. It was 2.5 hours long and I'm really glad because I don't know why directors and filmmakers are obsessed with keeping something like under 2 hours or 1.5 hours because they're worried that the audience won't keep their attention. I'm like, if you make any film good enough, people will watch it. Like, I was happily watching it for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And it was great. Like,
I was never bored. I would have been really happy for this to be a 4-hour miniseries.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when it ended. I was like, this could easily be a mini TV series. Because they added a bit more of Suge's background
yeah.
in the film and took out a few other details that I really would have liked to have seen. But overall, it was a very powerful film. It was made to a really high standard. The acting was amazing. The lighting was amazing. Like, there was such a... Like, I cried multiple times. And I think the reuniting of Nettie and Celie at the end was done beautifully.
Mm.
What about you?
It's hard because...
Do you want to pause?
Okay. Knowing the research that I've done, I think we got a version of The Color Purple, and that's what you get with an adaptation.
Absolutely.
But I really hope that the new adaptation comes with a black director.
Well, the only thing that makes it
such... And I just want to see how they see it.
Yeah. Because it's such a big problem because there are so few, like, and basically entirely black cast films.
Yeah.
And so when there are them... And
it has to hold... It has to be the story of everyone.
That's right. And yeah. basically every male character is a violent aggressor in the film. And Albert doesn't kind of get the redemption story he does in the book where... He reproposes to Celie as a friend because they actually get to know each other quite well because she's alone in her old home for a while Suge is off with the younger man.
Yeah.
And they bond and they
reconnect. Over their grief around Suge.
Yeah, over their grief of how they've both lost her. And he actually changes quite a lot and he is upset when he hears how she came to have 2 children. And she, like, he says to her, I didn't realize you were such good company. Like, it's not to humanize the abuser, but also, like, because I'm real happy to hate men. I don't need convincing that they mistreat women too easily and that kind of thing. But I think it was really good that, you know, there did come to be this mutual respect by the end. And Celie still turns down his proposal.
I don't think it's a justification, but I mean, it is really difficult to take that violence out of context and like not recognize that all of the men that were black who were committing acts of domestic violence were also dealing with an incredible amount of oppression.
That's right. And violence.
And violence from other directions from their white oppressors. And that's trauma that they certainly weren't getting help dealing with. Like, I'm sure counseling wasn't widespread back then.
Not at all.
And in the South, where some of the racism was the worst and where it could be very dangerous to be a black man, and it is still dangerous to be a black man, without help dealing and processing with that trauma, and in large farming communities where the next house is so far away, I'm sure that it felt very isolating.
Mm. I feel like it was interesting that Steven Spielberg decided to take that bit out of the story. Like, I really loved all the relationship between the women, and I think that it's really interesting to reflect on this film that was created in 1985, and it meets the Bechdel test when the Bechdel test wasn't invented until decades later, I don't think.
Ooh, I don't know. I feel like it could have come out in the 1980s.
Let me see.
So let's talk about the opening is really strong. The first bit of the story is done really well, adapted really well, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And can I just say that I'm so glad that it was nominated for the best sound design, because I really enjoyed the sound design of this film.
The Bechdel test was established in 1985 as well. Yeah. The same year the film came out. Yeah, you wrote a lot of notes during this film.
I did. The first time that Mr. Albert beats Seeley, there's a really good build with the diegetic sound, and then the music comes in, and when he hits her, the music cuts out, and that really adds the impact of the first time she's hit.
Mm.
So I really enjoyed this sound design. I also really enjoyed the symbolism of Seeley so frequently being seen as a shadow when she's with her sister Nettie, because Seeley really comes into herself over the course of the film. So there's two real big times. One of them is when they're doing the washing. Seeley's standing behind the sheets, and Nettie is standing in between them. So you see Nettie in full view, and you just see Seeley's shadow. And then later that night, when they're talking in their bedroom, you see Nettie in the doorway, and then Seeley's shadow is on the wall.
Mm.
And I thought that was really lovely. I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the relationship was built up between Nettie and Seeley so well that when they get separated, it is heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
And it's so early in the film.
We were both crying.
Yeah.
And it was like the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
But they're just young girls, you know? Like it...
I wrote down the poem they write. They do the little... me and you, us never part, mucky dada. Me and you, us half a heart, mucky dada. Ain't no ocean, ain't no sea, mucky dada. Keep my sister away from me, mucky dada.
And what's mucky dada?
It just seems to be the thing. I'm not sure what it said, but that's what I wrote down.
Yeah.
But I
was thinking that as well, and I was listening to it. I was like, I bet that is something, but I'm not sure what it is.
And I just felt like that was really nice, and I liked it. I liked when Harpo physically separates them, like their heads are together, and Mr. Albert, and he puts his hands in between them, like back of hand to push them apart, and I thought that was really visually interesting. Mm. I took heaps of notes. The blowing of the poster through the town was weird. Of Suge's poster. We kind of follow the poster. Maybe that's like a 1980s thing. Maybe I'm too young to... Like, I've seen other...
Normally that's a bit of a Western thing.
Yeah, I don't know. But I thought that was interesting. I thought
the portrayal of the mayor's wife was pretty perfect. Like, she was just this naive, stupid woman who thought so little of black people that any inconvenience to her is more important than their lives.
Yeah.
Like, she genuinely seems to not understand why it's so upsetting that Sophia doesn't get to see her children. She doesn't understand why Sophia has to just agree with her. And, like, you know, she's driving through town as Sophia's teaching her to drive. And she's just this stupid, silly woman.
She's so cheerful and so energetic.
Yeah.
And the contrast, and, like, it's like she seems like on paper a nice person.
Yeah.
But when you contrast it to Sophia sitting next to her, it's like, wow. You, like, the lack of empathy you're showing to Sophia is almost sociopathic.
Well, yeah, she does seem like a sociopath. Like, it, and then it's so obvious that when she's trying, in the film, we don't get this. Oh, no, we do get this in the book. She's trying to leave, but she can't figure out how to change the car from reverse into first gear. And the men who are still outside are trying to help her, and they try to get into the car because she's nearly crashing into their farming equipment, and she immediately is like, oh, they're trying to attack me.
So that part isn't in the book. The fact that she can't fix the car is in the book. And there was some criticism around that scene from Roger Ebert, who's like a notable reviewer. So he reviewed the film when it first came out, and then he said a more up-to-date review on kind of commenting on how he initially said it was easily the best movie of the year.
Mm.
And now he was like, I can see its flaws better with time, because he'll have become more educated, as we all have, on race relations and the controversies around the representation. And he said that it's very slapsticky and what could have been a really quiet moment, and that emphasized the pain of the situation rather than kind of the absurdity of it.
It's still pretty painful when Sophia's forced to get back into the car. Like, I absolutely see what he's saying, because they kind of, like...
But I feel like that's entirely carried on Oprah Winfrey's acting, which is stunning.
Yeah, she did an amazing job.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I like when she comes alive again in the dinner scene.
Yeah.
And well, that whole scene was ad-libbed as well.
It's almost, really?
Yeah, from Oprah Winfrey. She ad-libbed every part of that.
Because for me, what that symbolized was, as Celie came alive, it reminded Sophia of who she was, but it also reminded her that even when you're pushed so far beyond your breaking point, like Celie had been, because she was always a weaker character compared to Sophia, when Celie then stands up to Albert, Sophia is just so moved and inspired by that. She's like, wow. Like,
things are going to change.
Yeah, things are going to change.
And things can change.
Yeah.
So, you know, I said earlier that I think what there's some interesting around Sophia symbolized. So for me, there is a lot of criticism about the portrayal of black men and violence. And one of the criticisms was that it makes it seem like all of the problems within the black community come from the black community hurting people within themselves. And that's a criticism that happens today. Like, people always throw black on black violence up as a reason to disregard the way that white police officers teach.
Well, we don't
treat black citizens.
Well, yeah. They don't give all the context of, like, what we were talking about, how that violence is, like, cyclical. But I know you're going to keep saying something else, but it's, yeah, we don't get all that backstory of, like, how, like, Albert's father treated him and then Albert treats Harpo, but also, like, how if you are a black man and you go in the 1920s and you go into any kind of shopping situation and there'll be some, like, white teenage punk who will be running the store, and you'll be like, as a black man, you'd need to go in there and be like, oh, yes, sir, no, sir. And, like, of course that would be incredibly degrading and frustrating for you. And then you go home and take your anger over whoever you have power over.
Hmm. Absolutely. But also, so what for me, what happens when Sophia... So I don't see Sophia as someone who gets punished for being strong. What I see, what I get out of her story is that Sophia always stands up for herself, and she doesn't accept the violence that the black community shows towards each other. Mm. And she removes herself from that situation. She says, I'm going to lead a positive life.
Mm.
And she's one of the strong ones. And so when she gets beat by white people, it shows that it doesn't matter if you wanted to be a, you know, someone who changes the cycle of violence.
Mm.
Even if you're not, you know, even if you're trying to remove yourself and not be part of that, even if you're trying to be a leader within your community and within your family, no matter how strong you are, the power of white oppression is still stronger than you.
Mm.
In the sense that, like, you know, black people have their own problems within their own communities in the same way that white people have problems within their own communities.
Mm.
But that doesn't change that the biggest source of their oppression was white people.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot more to over, like, it. They had to work so hard inch by inch to overcome that. And you really get a sense of just how oppressive the force is through Sophia's story.
Mm.
And then also, we see all this pain in Celie's life. And then at the end, it gets put in perspective that a lot of that pain started because white people burned down her dad's store.
Right, and he was lynched.
Yeah.
Like, if her biological father was never murdered,
she might have had a different life.
She might have had a different life. She wouldn't have been raped by her stepfather and then sold off to Albert and...
Yeah.
All this shit. 100%.
So, like...
So, yeah, like, that isn't explicitly explained.
Exactly. But it's, and like, you don't get that connection. And I think black... yeah. Sorry.
No.
No, you go.
But it's so true, though. Like, it's not explicitly, like, telling you, like, this is a thing. Like, maybe her life would have been different if white people hadn't murdered her father. But I feel like it's on us, the reader, and white people in general, to ask ourselves those questions and to push ourselves to look further into any kind of situation. Like, I totally, like, obviously the criticism of the film is really valid and it shouldn't have been directed by a white man, but
then also what I wrote is, like, they're gonna have to cut out parts of the story, and I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with focusing a huge element of the story on Celie and Nettie's relationship. That's,
not at all.
It's really beautiful that, yeah, that you know, that's also a black story that probably hadn't been told on the big screen at that time.
Absolutely not.
And had a black director made those choices, I don't think it would have been as heavily criticized.
Mm.
But also, had there been just in general adequate black representation on the screen, I don't think it would have been as heavily criticized that, you know, we focus on those elements.
Yeah. Well, you read feedback and criticism about how women were saying, like, they knew Celie, they'd been Celie. Like, so it's not as though, and I'm sure the criticizers weren't saying this, they weren't saying that this kind of violence doesn't happen or isn't real, but it's just, I can imagine.
It's hard when that's the only story.
Well, that's the thing, and we've talked about that in regards to lesbian relationship representation or any kind of rainbow relationship, because a lot of the times the lesbian stories are really sad or really, you know, like the Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there's a lot of separation, there's a lot of...
it's tragic.
It's just tragic because...
Beautiful, but tragic.
Women, regardless of colour, a lot of the time in many situations, especially romantic ones, do not have the power or the choice. And so lesbian relationships are often either dismissed by the male counterparts because it's like, oh, that's cute or that's sweet. That's, you know, perfect example. It was never made illegal to be a lesbian in New Zealand because the relationship wasn't seen as legitimate as two men. Whereas, I don't know what my point was. Oh, yeah, my point was about... how it is frustrating. And then you see, like, you want films that represent the whole spectrum of things, but there just needs to be more films. There just needs to be films with more entirely black casts or just more black actors. There needs to be more, you know, representation in all film.
We need all the colors of their life.
Yes.
What?
No.
We do. We need to get to see all their stories, the happy ones, the sad ones, and everything in between.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that they didn't already have that, that visibility.
Yeah. And I don't know why I'm thinking of the Black Panther when we're talking about this, because obviously that's an entirely different end of the spectrum, but it is a positive black film.
Mm.
It does show violence between... warring tribes of people of color. I'm not sure. Black Panther 2 is going to be coming out, and I'm very interested to see what direction that goes in, considering that the lead actor is dead.
Yeah.
Can't believe he died from cancer.
Yeah.
He was battling cancer during the Black Panther, and he was still that ripped and, like,
amazing,
that healthy. Like, it was, yeah, it's crazy. I'm gonna look up his name. I should know his name.
I feel like it's right there. What do you think of the film as a film in and of itself? How would you rate it then?
Chadwick Boseman.
Yes. What a name. What's her name?
I mean, I'd say Eight Again.
It's a good film.
It's a really good film. I would happily rewatch it. It was very entertaining.
Would you happily rewatch it?
No, I mean in the sense that there are some films that are so boring. I would not watch them.
Okay, but what film?
What do you mean? Like, Eragon?
Okay.
I wouldn't watch it. I'd never watch that film again.
Would you watch Artemis Fowl again?
No.
Would you watch it inebriated?
No. There's no point. But...
Would you rewatch the Spoon movie? The Room?
I don't even know that I've watched it the whole way through. I would watch that inebriated. But it's funny, but that's a different type of bad.
Yeah.
That's like comical because you can't believe that people are doing it genuinely.
Okay.
Whereas with like Eragon, and don't do that, you'll hear the noise. They were genuinely trying to make a good movie and all that money was wasted, but they just failed so hard.
You don't know that he wasn't trying to make a good movie with The Room. There are lots of theories.
No, he was trying to make a good movie, but he failed.
Oh, okay. It's just in a different way.
It's different.
Okay.
But I would have loved to have seen more of the lesbian relationship between Celie and Shug, but I still really appreciate all of the female relationships. Like, there's... what's her name now? I've forgotten it. Squeak, Shug, Sophia, Nettie, Celie. Like, all those women kind of interact. We don't get as much of the jealousy between Nettie and the Reverend's wife.
Yeah.
But that whole thing is cut down to like 10%
of what it is in the book. Yeah, we get heaps in the book.
Yeah, we do, and it's really great. But I still really appreciate like the fact that, you know, Steven Spielberg did focus so much and give so much screen time to just the women talking and being together. And I love the scene where Sophia and Harpo go into Celie's store to buy some pants, and I thought that was great. And I really liked how, you know, it shows, for me it was really interesting watching the flip of Celie's character. Like, she's so competent about the pants, she's so confident, she's giving them to Harpo, she's like, just try them on, and she's being authentically herself, and she's talking, and she's like, blah, 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 and then she sees Albert out the window, and she all, like, it's almost like she gets smaller all of a sudden, like, and I always find that so interesting.
Whoopi Goldberg as an actress has great physicality.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I thought the way that she portrayed being 19, which is how old her character is, when you first see her in the film.
As Whoopi Goldberg and like, not the other actress, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, you look like a baby.
Mm.
And she did it so well when she was playing that meek wife. Well, like, she was handing Albert all these things that she knew that he was forgetting. And I just get so angry at that scene where Albert's like, you're nothing, you're useless. And I'm like, she literally kept your life together.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful that there was that scene where Albert, like, he, I don't know where his children were. Maybe they'll grow up and left. And he was alone and everything was a mess and he was drinking and the animals had run of the house. I think for me, what I missed the most was Celie, like, we didn't get to see in the film where Celie gets her apology from Albert, basically. Like, he doesn't actually apologize in the book, but he...
He's like the quiet one to like, he quietly redeems himself.
Yeah.
But I think the redemption in the book is much better because redemptions don't happen quickly. They happen like that kind of redemption happens over years.
Yeah.
That absolutely. Kind of change is huge.
And that change was still over years. We obviously didn't get to see that because, you know, Celie does leave for years and she comes back and she does look really different. She does look very confident. She's got different clothes. She's smoking and she's like, hey, here I am.
Oh, yeah. Her outfit when she comes back for the funeral is great.
Yeah. And so, you know, she obviously has grown and she has a lot more confidence in herself.
And she shimmies, which I really liked because she couldn't shimmy at the beginning.
Yeah, she shimmies when she sees the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I thought was really fun. And I really like how she shakes hands with the child that was married to her stepfather because she gets the money and so... they're leaving, but there's still, I feel like there were so many positive female relationships in the film, And I really like that because there is a stereotype of like woman being jealous, and Avery, Suge Avery even asks Celie why she's not jealous of her sleeping with Albert, and Celie's like, I don't give a fuck. Like, I do not want to sleep with Albert, like, at all. And I just thought there were so many positive relationships between women in the film, and I really like that. Because I think in real life, women can't survive. And I obviously, I'm just saying male and female. There are so many genders and sexualities on the spectrum. I'm oversimplifying it for the language of the film. But in life, like, I wouldn't survive without the love and companionship and friendship of my female friends.
Absolutely.
Like, no way.
Absolutely. 100%. I agree. And I love that. I love that we're seeing more of that. I love that we have this as well. I love the scene between Suge and Celie where Suge teaches Celie to smile and, like, take her hand away from her mouth.
Yeah.
I think it's so beautiful. And it's just, it's really lovely.
Yeah. And she's basically unteaching what her rapist stepfather said, where it's just like, you know, because she starts covering it when he's like, you have an ugly smile.
Yeah.
And then Suge's like, you have a beautiful smile. And then, you know, Nettie teaches Celie how to read so that they can write to each other and stay in touch.
Mm.
What did you rate the film in and of itself?
Yeah, it's real good. Like, I really liked it.
Yeah.
8?
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's really good. Like, obviously it doesn't have everything, but I think sometimes films don't have everything, but that doesn't mean what they did do wasn't great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It captures a huge... I think it is a good adaptation of a white person's perception who is sympathetic to the African-American experience, what they would read from the book. And also a white male perspective, because Steven Spielberg said that he didn't feel comfortable with the lesbianism. And to be perfectly honest, I'm kind of glad that he didn't do it, because if he had and failed to do it well, it would have really taken away from the film.
Yeah, and it...
And it I didn't want it to be weird.
Yeah, and it might have changed how successful it was in the 1980s when it came out.
Yeah.
I looked it up, and Steven Spielberg does have a sister. And so I do wonder about, like, you know, if that helped with the way he portrayed the relationship between Celie and Nettie.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed the film. It made me feel a lot. I think it still makes me feel a lot. I think Steven Spielberg clearly understands building up suspense in scenes.
Oh, yeah.
And how to break humor.
I read another piece about how Alice Walker was originally quite worried that Steven Spielberg was directing the film. Mm. And then she saw E.T. and felt more confident in him because she felt like E.T. was treated as a person of color.
Yeah.
And that,
I need to watch E.T. I've never seen it. All right, probably I did see it when I was a kid, but I don't remember it. Yeah,
we should both rewatch it. It's got a very young Drew Barrymore in it.
Yeah, there's, and like I said, like, some of the best lines from the film are the ones taken right out of Alice Walker's hands, like, your dead body be just the welcome mat I need. That was great. Fuck, that's a great line. I love the curse part. I love that in the book, and I love it in the film. Until you do right by me, everything that you think of is going to crumble. Mm. I'm poor, I'm black, I may even be ugly, but dear God, I'm here. And I think what a powerful statement, you know? I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, like, to say that and to say it confidently, like, I exist. Just kind of going back to it as an adaptation, the addition with Suge Avery's thing, his plot line, is nice. I like the empowerment of women and, like, kind of the exception, like, the acceptance of women who... were like Suge, who were like, I'm going to love and be loved by the men that I choose to love and be loved by, and by the women that I choose to love and be loved by, and I'm going to drink, and that doesn't mean I don't believe in God. Mm. And I think that's an important story, and I think that was an important story in the 1980s, and I think it's an important story today.
Absolutely. I'm not sure if this is in a romantic sense, but Alice Walker is no longer with her spouse, Melvin. They divorced in 1976. But it says partner, and there's a guy called Robert, but there's also Tracy Chapman. And I'm not sure if that's referring to romantically or not, or maybe it's just, like, professionally. But if it is romantically, I'm wondering, like, if Alice Walker is bisexual.
It's hard because partner has multiple meanings.
Yeah, And, like, it would be really interesting if she was bisexual, because obviously she wrote Celia as a lesbian.
Mm.
And Shug Avery is a bisexual woman.
Yeah. I have a biography or a collection of essays about Alice Walker's work.
Oh, it was romantic! Sorry, I found it!
Oh, great.
Yep. Walker has claimed she was in a romance with singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman in the mid-1990s, saying it was delicious and lovely and wonderful, and I totally enjoyed it, and I was completely in love with her, but it's nobody's business but ours.
That's great. Love that.
Yeah.
Love that for her. I also really love this scene where Mr. Albert is chasing or running alongside the tree line that Nettie's on the other side.
That was terrifying.
It was terrifying, but it was so well done because really it's so well clear that Nettie feels like she's being chased. And he thinks it's a game.
He thinks it's fun.
And it's flirty.
Oh, I could throw up. And then he has flowers in his hair. Like, he thinks he's being romantic.
And Nettie is like...
you're literally...
You're married to my sister.
Yeah, and you're also... trying to rape me.
Yeah.
Like, she's like screaming no. And I don't, like, is he, I don't know. Like, yeah. What's wrong with him?
Well, I think he convinced himself that the only reason they weren't together was because of her father.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I don't know. I wouldn't have minded if Celia had just cut his throat. Like, why do you think Shug was so, like, against in her the doing film? That?
Because that scene's not in the book. Although,
no, well, Shug does tell Celia not to murder him in the book.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen like that.
No.
I think it's one of those things that's quite nuanced, right? People aren't only one thing. You know, you look at the boy involved in the Columbine shootings, and with his mom, you listen to her TED talk, like, to her, he was a very sweet boy. And that doesn't take away from all the pain that he caused, but people aren't only one thing.
To me, it was just that Shug didn't want Celia to go to jail.
Okay. That's what you got to tell yourself.
Because that's basically what Sophia says. I know the scene wasn't in the book as well, but it's what Sophia says when... Celia has a knife to Albert's throat.
Yeah.
She's like, you know, it's not worth it. Don't go through what I've gone through.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure jail in the 1950s by then, would be absolutely horrific for people of colour.
Yeah. It can be absolutely horrific for people of colour now. It's just a fun world.
To live in yeah. general. Shall we wrap up?
Yep.
Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Alice Walker, what a genius.
What a genius.
Honestly.
Absolutely. Yeah, incredible writer.
So glad to have this as part of our season. I'm so glad we did it.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we did it, even though I knew that it would be really upsetting. Yeah. But I thought the film was done really well. Like, and you were right, Brie and I were talking about how some rape scenes are glorified and are done like rape porn. And it's just really horrific. Like, 12 Years a Slave has some horrific rape scenes that I found really upsetting. Like, and we shouldn't avoid these things, shouldn't avoid talking about them. At the same time, you need to take care of yourself and your well-being and self-care. But, yeah, I thought so much violence was implied and so much trauma was implied that, and at the end of the day, you get it. You do get it. You don't need to see it. You don't need to be disturbed by it to be, like, impacted by something. Yeah. And I thought, you know, obviously I agree that I don't think a white man should have directed it, but I think he still did do a good job of making the film. Like, it is still a good film.
Yeah.
From my, you know, that's my wide opinion. Of course.
And I guess we don't have to do a revamp, remake, retire, because it's already being revamped.
Revamped. Yes, but that's also what I want.
Yeah. I'm very interested to see how it unfolds. And
I hope it's not just a rumor.
Yeah, I hope it's not just a rumor as well. Like, yeah. I really want
to
see it.
It's crazy to think.
And I also want to see the musical.
Yeah, I really want to see the musical. I think that would be really good. I also want to see the musical for Billy Elliot. But I am really interested to see, like, what the 2023 film would look like.
Mm.
And how maybe... Because there's a lot of technological progress in the novel and the film, because it is over Celie's entire life.
Yeah.
And so it goes from, like, horse and cart to people having cars, and the whole, like, and that's kind of more implied and talked about in Nettie's story, with the progress of roads and, like, the war being brought into it, because they would need all the rubber from Africa. But yeah, if they do it in 2023, I want to know, or I'll be really interested to see how they bring up more police brutality into it, because obviously that's a huge thing at the moment. That's a huge thing being talked about. And
it's interesting to see it unroll on in TV right now. Brooklyn Nine-Nine has already touched on it, but I know I've heard rumors they're going to touch on it in the new season. I'm interested to see how these things are going to be handled moving forward.
This is the last season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I feel like it hasn't been out in years. Obviously, COVID pushed back everything.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Wonderful. Okay. I'm happy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you all right?
I'm great. This was, honestly, this was such a treat. Like, it's fun to review really bad films as well. It wouldn't be fun to review this film if it were bad, because it's such an important story. It would be very upsetting. I'd be pissed. Yeah. It's really nice to be exposed to a book that's so well written and so moving and such an important story, and to see it adequately and adapted with care on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We hope that you're all right. Definitely recommend reading the book or watching the film, but please do be aware of the trigger warnings and taking care of yourself. You know where to find us. We're on Facebook. We're chapter1take2@outlook.com, ch1tk2 on Twitter. If you have any thoughts or any things that we missed, we're more than happy to talk with you about that.
Absolutely.
And next week we will be covering Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen?
Probably.
What would we be doing otherwise?
Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures, that's right.
By Margot Lee Shetterly.
Yeah. Wonderful. This has been part of season 2, our female-led literature and film. Again, my apologies for the noise. We only have so much time in our lives, and we needed to record this when we could. But yeah, I had a lovely day in Kaikoura with you today. We picked some shells.
We did.
It was great.
We plucked them off trees. There's just seashell trees.
Seashells growing for days.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Kia ora.
Bye. You hit stop, baby.
Oh, I know.